Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar, designing and installing commercial and residential solar arrays to power homes and businesses with the sun. Solar energy is a renewable energy source. AllEnergySolar.com.
Wisconsin Public Radio brings you thoughtful and engaging discussions every day. Authors, artists, politicians, and voices from around the state. You'll hear them all. And you can be part of the conversation, too, on air or online at WPR.org.
Thanks for listening along on WPR. We're talking about facing burnout at your job on the show today, to begin it at least. Larry Mueller here, and our guest, Dr. Shyla Merghain. She's a distinguished psychologist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Been with us many a time. Are you worried you might have burnout and not sure what to do? Maybe you're looking for answers on what you can do to get your energy and your motivation back. We'll take your general mental health questions as well. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Shyla Merghain, good to have you back.
All right. Thank you for having me, Larry.
Well,
great
it's
to be here.
Well, it's great to have you with us once again, and a topic that may not be the most fun one to talk about sometime, but burnout is certainly there. I have some friends who I think may be suffering burnout, one in particular. How do you recognize burnout, and how's it different from just regular old stress?
That's a great question, Larry. And I think the workforce is often feeling tired, where at times in our career, we can encounter burnout. It is quite normal for people as they're progressing through their years in the workforce to reach a time where they just feel burned out. And stress is certainly related to job burnout, but I think about stress as being a discrete period of time where maybe you're working on a project with a tight deadline and having to put in those hours. But once those factors are taken away, you go back to normal. While burnout is really a sense of just feeling worn out physically and emotionally. And what can make job burnout so challenging is that it usually involves feelings of feeling powerless or useless or even empty. And it can raise the risk for depression. So I want to talk today about what causes burnout, but also what the remedy is for burnout if and when it happens.
Yeah, it's good to know both parts for sure. Well, so the cause of burnout then is?
I think it can be a couple things. I think being in a job where you don't feel valued for your work, where you're not enjoying what you're doing, maybe where you feel like you're letting your boss down or you're surrounded with more negative coworkers. I think those can be some of those triggers or risk factors for burnout. I think sometimes we can look at being in an environment where there's just an intensity and fast pace for too long of a period of time, and you're not getting that downtime that you need. So working in a really intense environment for a long time. And I think then we also can look at other factors outside of work. Like if you find yourself dealing with some life challenges, and maybe it's an illness in the family, or maybe you're an empty nester, or your children are going through something challenging. I think that can be a contributor to burnout, where you feel like you just don't have the resources that you used to deal with work-related stressors. You're kind of coming in a sense, half empty, because so much of your resources are spent in things outside of work. And then certainly there are psychological risk factors, like if you are struggling with a mental health condition like depression, or maybe you've had past work experiences that have been really challenging, that could be some of those certain personality characteristics that can affect the risk of burnout.
I'm wondering, do you think it's more common than it used to be, or maybe we're just more aware of it?
I think it can be more common. You know, gone are the days of people working for one organization for your entire career surrounded by coworkers that become like family. Mm-hmm. I also think the work world is consistently changing with advances in technology or AI, and they can be hard to keep up with. And plus, there is a hybrid that many people are working remotely and in person. And I think what is missing is some of that social connection, the chit-chat over in the break room, over the coffee dispenser, that can leave people feeling more isolated and lonely, and sitting in front of a screen for more hours dealing with complex issues that can take a lot. It can be draining. And as a result, people can start to feel more burned out.
Yeah, or even just not being in the workplace.
Yes. Yeah.
You
know, I mean, there's so many.
Doing this all from your house.
Yep, where you don't have that distinct break between, driving to work, getting out, going to your desk. If you're working from home, in a sense, work can bleed over into the evening hours, or it could be the first thing you're checking when you wake up. And so you never get kind of that detachment from work. And then you also don't have those, what I call micro boosts, that you get from just the chit chat with your coworkers, like, hey, how was your weekend? Or, hey, let's take a walk over the lunch hour. I think that doesn't give you that little recharge that often we need during a work day.
I know you have some tips on how to handle job burnout, and you mentioned detaching psychologically from work.
Yeah. So, you know, I do want to also just mention, like, for people to identify, gosh, when am I burning out? Because I think early intervention is key, that if you find yourself dragging yourself to work, or you're having trouble getting started, or you feel more irritable, or you feel just totally detached from work, like you're going through the motion, or maybe you're lacking energy, or it's hard to just focus on what you're doing and concentrating, or maybe you're having a lot, you're losing confidence and doubting yourself, or even some physical complaints, or maybe your sleep isn't as good as it used to, and you're waking up again in the middle of the night feeling that dread, or you're using food or drug or alcohol to numb yourself. And then to your question, you know, it's so important of detaching from work. Again, I think in our modern work world, we can feel connected at the hip to our job. First thing we check in the morning is our email, you know, our work email, or when we go to bed at night or in the evening after dinner with our family, we might check that work email and feel that call to respond. Or many people feel like in the weekends they're still working. So it is so important for long-term well-being, and especially if we're starting to get into that burnout, to detach. And we know detachment leads to just better recovery from work-related stress, and it improves even our work product, our performance and engagement at work. And sometimes we feel like, gosh, I just need to spend more hours at work to lead to better performance. But if I work with athletes, and we find the secret sauce to athletic performance is rest and recovery. And the same is true for work performance as well.
Yeah. John in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wonder what I feel like there's a role for lowering the amount of hours one needs to work and increasing the amount of pay. I mean, the idea was initially to have 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, and 8 hours for what you will. However, that what you will is often taken up by our commute to work and eroded by, like, other basic taking care of ourselves activities. I feel like having less than 8 hours of work a day might actually be better. I mean, working from home helps with that, but sometimes that's not always the best thing for everybody, too.
Yeah. Comment, Shyla?
Absolutely. And I think some companies are going to a 4-day work week, or in summers having maybe that Friday off. And I think companies that have experimented with some of that flexibility in the workday, even some companies allow you to work the hours that you want to. We actually find that there's still great productivity. And I think, John, you're so right that just being able to have those longer breaks from work are really, really important. And I think, you know, we're talking about detaching from work, but I think, again, we have this compulsion to maybe check our phone and check in on work during those off hours. And research shows, and I think this is really striking, Larry, that research shows that even thinking about work detracts from your ability to recover it. And the mere presence of your phone distracts you and leaves you feeling unable to detach from the office. So we're talking about physical detachment, like getting away from work, getting away from your desk or computer, but also psychologically, like maybe you don't talk about work in the evening with your spouse, or maybe you choose not to check your data, your work email at bedtime or in the when you first wake up. So you can give yourself that break.
Micro breaks. You talk about taking micro breaks during the day. What's an example of a micro break?
Absolutely. So a micro break is, it could be a couple things. So we think about, let's say traditionally we're working for 8 hours, that if we can take like a 10-minute work break during the workday, that research again shows is surprisingly effective for recovering from work stress and various job demands. So this could be, again, that chit-chat over the coffee pot at the work workstation, work break room, so some of those social interactions. It could be doing some meditation. It could be taking a short walk, or even just something like maybe you bring a book and you're reading it, or reading the latest sports article, or maybe you're even bringing in a craft, like doing some knitting during the workday. And what this finds is that it can really help keep our mood up and sustain that energy. And just taking that break can improve motivation and concentration. And then it's always good to take a longer break. So take that lunch hour. There was one study that looked at what people did during their lunch hour. And those extroverted colleagues found it wonderful to have that lunch break with coworkers and chat and talk about things outside of work. So just chat about families or what you did on the weekend or your evening. But they found that those people who are a little more introverted and when they ate, had that lunch break with colleagues, found that their energy level was depleted, more depleted by the end of the day. So just encouraging people to take the lunch break, but also be mindful around how you utilize that time. If you're a little more introverted, our weather's getting warmer, maybe it's nice to just get outside and take a brief walk. Or again, maybe you're bringing a book and reading it. But sometimes we feel like, gosh, if I just work through the lunch hour, I'll get done earlier. But we actually find more mistakes can be made. We lose focus. We feel more drained versus taking that time just to recharge. We end the day more productive, more accomplished. And again, energy and vitality a little more stabilized.
John and Madison, thank you so much. Let's turn to Chelsea in Hartford. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi. I have a question about not so much burnout in the workplace, but at home. My husband and I both, we work 8-hour days, 5 days a week, and we both have the energy, like, right when we get home. He gets home earlier than I do, and I get home later, and I have a commute, but we get home, and I'm right away cooking dinner. He's right away getting things ready for the family and all this stuff, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, we still have 8 loads of laundry to do, or dishes, or like just tidying up, or we have to fix this or do that. And I find in the last few months, my husband and I both have felt that burnout sensation towards our home chores, not so much during our work day, but it's just that transition of we cooked, we cleaned up from dinner, but now we have our deeper cleaning, our deeper duties to do that. And it's like, oh, no, I just want to sit down and take a break.
I can relate to that. What do you think, Shyla?
Yeah, I can relate to that as well, Chelsea. And I was actually thinking about that as I was preparing for today, that we're talking about work burnout, but there can be burnout just from life burnout or chore burnout, or I was even thinking kids can experience some social burnout from some of the social pressures. And I think, Chelsea, you're really describing what it's like in modern living. You work an entire day and then you come home and there are like too many chores to keep up with. Like cleaning the house can feel like there's less time available to deal with everything that's coming in the house. And how do you get it all done? And, you know, I think it allows us to think about a couple things. Like, one, can we simplify any of the tasks? For example, maybe picking up our groceries, you know, ordering them and doing the drive up and picking them up the way so we save an hour from grocery shopping. You know, can we, I don't know, use kind of utensils that maybe save time with washing and maybe using some disposable utensils or paper plates or things like that. So sometimes there are some life hacks, but again, I want to normalize that this can happen, right? I think it's happened to so many of us. And what at the heart of it is information that we need to find better balance. So if we're just working all day, and sometimes people call the home chores like a second shift that we have to come and do, and then we fall asleep exhausted. It's, again, it's information to give ourselves permission to rebalance. So thinking about using the same principles, like how do you detach from some of the chores and do something fun? Like the laundry will wait, the dusting will wait, right? No one's died from a little dust on the table. And maybe you and your husband give yourself permission just to take a walk when you get home, or plan a date night, or schedule something that you would really enjoy, like going to trivia night or seeing a show or going out to the movie theater or even just having a TV show series you look forward to watching. So again, something that will recharge and reinvigorate. And so sometimes that requires a little bit of shifting the flow and how we're doing things, but also maybe a little planning and preparation so we're not missing the good stuff, the things that really uplift us. And I think that's really important with families and children, too, because kids often can feel a bit burned out, especially from the social pressures as they age. And it's so important to think about helping them recharge as well.
Chelsea, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Our guest today, Dr. Shyla Mergane, distinguished psychologist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, as we talk about handling burnout at work, but it looks like other places as well. You can join in with your own questions or experience. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today, our technical director, Tyler Ditter. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at how to handle burnout at work or other places as well with our guest, Dr. Shyla Mergane of the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Questions or experience to share, give a call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Sue emailed us, could you comment on the possibility of burnout in retirement? As an active retiree, everyone thinks people like me have all the time in the world, so we are expected to volunteer for everything. Retirees need balance in their lives, too, to work with their aging process.
So thank you for bringing that up. I think that's such an important just a reflection around retirement and what is a good balance. I think burnout can happen because sometimes in retirement, people don't have enough to do. They've lost that sense of purpose and meaning with their jobs and are struggling, just feeling like they're going through a daily grind, going through the motions, and there isn't enough, in a sense, stimulation and excitement. And as you're saying, Sue, sometimes on the other side, we can get ourselves feeling like we're working 150% with all the causes and volunteers and clubs and social events, and there's no time just to breathe and be. And so finding, again, that balance, and making sure we're prioritizing what's most important, how we do want to spend that time. We do know in retirement, we can either stagnate or a concept called generativity, where we do feel revitalized and like we do have a mission and there is some purpose. So think of a person stagnating, that's probably good to schedule some more exciting activities. We do know that we talked about rest and recharge, like, okay, do some meditation or maybe do some reading a book, more kind of slower restorative practices. But we do know actually for recharging and a prescription for burnout is to engage in more effortful activities, like things like getting out and exercising. It can be good, like doing a yoga class or taking that hike, or maybe you're doing pickleball in retirement or going for a swim, or maybe you're also just engaging, learning a new hobby that's stretching you a little bit, like you're taking up a language or you're learning an instrument, or you're taking classes to hone a craft or skill set you have. And as you said, Sue, we also want to be aware of what we're committing to, so we're not depleting ourselves by getting stretched too thin. So sometimes that requires saying no to some things and saying yes to what you really want to be doing with your time. Good. And I think that's so important.
Yeah, very, very good points. Diane and Nina has something for us. Hi, Diane.
Well, hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I was listening. I'm in the car. Mm-hmm. Pulled over. My son, I put too many hours in my job. And my son, when he was grown, he looked at me and he said, Mom, do you want to work to live or live to work? And I thought that was really like, ooh, the bells went off for me. And I wish I had heard that earlier in my career, because the expectations were way too high and I bought into them. And you can't get the time back. You know, your life goes so quickly. And I just thought that was a really good comment.
Yeah. Diane, thanks for calling. Comment, Shyla.
Oh, Diane, I love that. That living to work and not buying into the maybe larger culture here in the United States or Wisconsin, you know, just kind of the working to live. And I think you're right. I think sometimes it takes, we have to give ourselves permission to do it differently, to set that boundary with work. I know one of my colleagues, it was so inspiring to see that during his residency, every day he left at around 5 or 5:30 so he could have dinner with his family. And that was just a boundary he set to begin with. Or I've seen people in workplaces say, I'm not going to check email on the weekend or after whatever time in the evening. And that's just a boundary they set because their family is a priority. So, Diane, I think you're really giving people permission to reflect on, in this life we're living, right? People always say everyone's replaceable on one's deathbed, right? That if with this life we're living, what's most important? How do we want to spend our time? Even thinking in the next year, like what would we be really glad that we said yes to? And maybe what are some things that it's time for us to say no to so we're showing up for what matters most?
Thank you very much, Diane, for pulling over with your car and calling in. Appreciate it. You can do that, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Let's say you need to talk to your boss. How do you start a conversation with your employer about the fact that you're suffering burnout?
I think that's a great question, Larry, because we're talking about setting boundaries or maybe being a little assertive or renegotiating with your boss or your work team to see what changes can occur. And I think it takes a bit of courage and vulnerability. And some bosses will be receptive, some aren't. So I want to encourage people to read the room, so to speak, or know how the conversation is going to go. Because sometimes there are just changes we can make on our own. And then sometimes it is reasonable and actually very fruitful to have a conversation, a frank conversation with our boss. And I think one, kind of naming what's going on, that you're finding yourself maybe being in a place where you are feeling burned out, and then having a conversation with your boss, negotiating for change. Like, can there be projects you can delegate to somebody else, or you can get help with, or maybe you can change the deadline. Or we've talked about maybe setting that boundary around work hours, that, you know, you're not going to check the email after hours. Or I also like to say, maybe I've had people do this, that they say to their boss, I'm going to just build in some breaks. I had somebody meditating and the boss thought that person was napping. And he said, no, I'm meditating. So even just saying, you know, I'm going to take a couple micro breaks and I'm going to take that lunch hour. So that's just going to be that kind of self-care. So I think, and hearing what the boss has to say as well.
Yeah. Well, we think about burnout as a kind of a personal problem. In other words, we tend to think that people who suffer from burnout might not just be as mentally resilient or might not be able to deal with stress as well as other people can. But how much responsibility do our employers have in managing burnout?
Yeah, great point. Right. And I want to normalize that. I think almost everyone at a particular time in their career will experience burnout. So I actually think it's part of what a coworker calls like the hero or heroine's journey in the workforce, that, you know, there's the initial stage of your career, you're excited and maybe you have mentoring, but then you might encounter some trials and tribulations and starting to burn out, and then hopefully rounding the corner, rounding the bend to that kind of recovery, and maybe even a renewed sense of purpose. And I do think, right, our workplaces, even management, leadership, bosses, it really pays for them to understand the causes to burnout and the remedies, and have conversations during the annual review with their employees around, how are you doing? What kind of improvements can you make? We just did that at UW Health with my boss. She asked, did a survey, and we had conversations in our team around what would be helpful in terms of preventing burnout. And she decided to make the mandatory meetings not mandatory, to allow people some flexibility around when they attended or not attended. So I think sometimes there are more possibilities than we realize, but it's good for managers to have a pulse and to maybe shift things up around how things are done, or give people, I think, flexibility. I think if you feel a little free and have that flexibility in the workplace, then you have permission to do a little bit of self-care.
Yeah. You know, just thinking about it, just in general, it seems that U.S. work culture makes us tend to blame individual employees and not the employer for problems like burnout.
Right. And I think it's, you know, there are institutional factors that contribute to the vulnerability to burnout. And there can be some individual factors as well. I don't think it's an either or, but a both and. And certainly, you know, Wellness Wednesdays, you know, don't solve the problem if there are larger institutional factors. But, you know, I think there was one other, I think, really important thing that I wanted to encourage people, and that is just your environment. You know, we're talking about institutional organizations or U.S. workforce, or here in Wisconsin, kind of this kind of work, go, go, go. And I wanted, especially springtime, just talk about getting out in nature. We do know a lot of companies are aware of this, and we see some newer buildings being built where there's more exposure to natural elements, like there's more natural sunlight, or there is walking paths, or bringing in nature into the office. And we do find that exposure to sunlight or daylight, having views of nature, even having artwork of nature or screens of nature, can really have benefits from recovery. So bringing in nature to your workplace, or getting out in nature during your workday, can just really revitalize you. And we find even as little as 10 minutes out in nature, people come back in to work feeling more focused, more energy, and more vitality. So maybe even a boss can have a meeting, taking a walk with a colleague, a coworker. That would do wonders, I think, for that person today.
Yeah, probably. And there are companies with high burnout rates. How difficult is it for a company with a high burnout rate to change, since, you know, these companies tend to have organizational and management problems?
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, it can be very challenging, especially if things have always been done a certain way. But, you know, I think about it as a trickle-down effect, that if leaders, managers, bosses, they need to take care of themselves and their burnout rates. They're often struggling with burnout as well, that more is coming at them than time available. But I think if there's some movement of them prioritizing their well-being, then there's a trickle down throughout all layers of the organization to encouraging others to take care of themselves. And that even just could be checking in on how the person's doing and, you know, even modeling, hey, I went for a walk over my lunch hour. What are you doing for your self-care? That can be really, really powerful.
Richard in Two Rivers, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Hey, man, I've had a lot of jobs recently, and what I found out is what some people consider a bad situation, other people consider a good situation. So when do you get to the point where you just say, you know, you got to toughen up, buttercup?
Yeah, I think you jump from the frying pan into the fire, you know, so to speak. Yeah, Richard, I think sometimes, right. I mean, I don't know if there is a perfect place of employment out there, and sometimes good enough might be good enough. And then just working on some of these strategies as well to say, you know, how do I take care of myself? And I also think having somebody who's like-minded in the workplace can be really helpful. A colleague you feel safe and you can vent with during the workday. That kind of is like a pressure cooker, releases some of that pressure valve to help during the day release some of that stress to recharge.
What can companies, or what's your advice for people who are new to a company, or maybe they're in a lower level position, or probably maybe younger? How can they learn to say no and sort of set limits?
I think that, yeah, people who are newer to the workforce or maybe new in a company, I think it can be hard at the beginning, but trying to find some mentors and maybe folks who have been there for longer to see what they're doing. Because if you see an example of something that has gone well for somebody, then you're more likely to advocate for it yourself and more likely to implement it. So mentorship, certainly early in career, is very helpful. And I would say also trying to implement it within the first 6 months of your job. Sometimes it's harder if you, for example, always work through lunch, then a year or two later deciding not to. Maybe your boss is used to you working through lunch. So trying to implement it earlier rather than later.
John emailed us. He heard of a radical idea for a progressive progressive podcast about splitting the year into 4 months for work, 4 months for vacation, and 4 months for meaningful action, like volunteering, political action, research, community organizing, anything so long as it contributes back to society in a meaningful way. The podcast called it their 4-4-4 month idea.
I love that. I love that. A year well lived, right? Travel, and even if it's a staycation, you know, traveling around your local community or Wisconsin, that was meaningful life activities, that sense of purpose with volunteering or service or contribution, and then work. And certainly we probably all, most of us can't do a literal 4-4-4, but we could divide our time throughout our week in that way. That's great.
Yeah, it's a kind of a cool idea. Well, let's get to the nub of this a little bit. How can you know if it's time to take the big step of quitting your job because of burnout?
Oh, that is a great question, Larry. And I think if you've tried everything, if you find that it's you're again dreading everything, that you know that it's no longer working for you, maybe you've tried to work with your boss, you're finding your coworkers maybe aren't that supportive, and it's maybe having just a, taking a toll on your physical and mental health, then it might be time to walk away or at least search for another job and have an exit strategy, whether you say, I'm going to transition to another job or I'm just going to simply quit. There definitely comes a place in time where that's the healthiest choice.
Buck in Sturgeon Bay will give you a chance. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I see people today being overconsumed with buying stuff. And clutter creates anxiety that spills over into your job sometimes. And we all know how many people got to have all these monthly payments, the brand new car, the big truck. But debt-free is a fantastic feeling, and then you no longer feel like you have the handcuffs on at your job, and that can help lower anxiety. Now, I'm self-employed, so I don't have to go to my boss and ask for time off or anything, but when you don't have that proverbial gun to your head to make money, you tend to look at life a little differently.
Yeah.
So I would say work for being debt-free and buy less junk and have less clutter in your life. That'll make work more fun.
Buck, thank you for calling. What do you think, Shyla?
I love it, Buck. Thank you. What a great note to highlight the simpler, right? Less consumeristic. We need less things, right? That's not what we never remember the stuff we purchased or gave to our kids. What we remember are the experiences. And so financial freedom allows us just more choice. We maybe can retire earlier. We can quit a job or choose a job that maybe we're earning less, but is more soul satisfying. And so I think great for people to work maybe with a financial planner on how do you reduce, eliminate that debt so you can have more freedom and choices in life, including maybe some shifts with your work life.
Yeah, good, very good points. And on that note, we are about out of time, Shyla. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today, and I'm sure we'll do this again. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Larry. It was a real honor to be here today.
Dr. Shyla Mergane, distinguished psychologist. She resides in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Well, how much time are your kids spending on screens or your grandkids? Screens are hard to avoid these days, and we'll take a look at that, especially as it relates to your children. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at screens and the amount of time children spend with screens. They're all pretty hard to avoid. I'm just looking at what I'm looking at right now, and I have four screens in front of me. One of them's a split screen, so I'm looking at, well, actually a triple screen, so I'm looking at 3, 4, 5, 6 different items of information on four different screens. That's kind of my day every day, but we're going to turn our attention more to children. I think there's too much time children spend with screens, and I think it might delay their development. And we'll be talking about that today with our guest, Jeff Ryland. Jeff is a child and family therapist with Gunderson Health System Behavioral Health. He's based out of La Crosse. And as we talk with him, hope you'll join in. What are you wondering about how screen time affects the youngsters in your life? Looking for ways to reduce screen time for yourself or your kids? You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Jeff, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show. Great to have you with us today.
You're welcome. I'm excited to be here. This is fun.
So, what are the current pediatric guidelines about screen time for children? Let's get some base here.
And this is always a stressful conversation to have because most parents usually exceed those guidelines. And I have to say, they're kind of a hard thing to reach, but they've been around for a long time. The American Academy of Pediatrics has had guidelines for about 3 decades. They have evolved a little bit. They're trying to be a little more flexible, in my opinion. But what they're saying is until 18 months of age, that's a year and a half, limit screen use to video chatting along with an adult. So if you're having FaceTime with grandma or grandpa, that kind of a conversation, not putting kids in front of a television to watch a movie or a video at that young age. Between ages 18 and 24 months, screen time should be limited to watching educational programming with a caregiver. So again, with an adult. So co-regulating, co-watching with an adult. And it's, 20 to 30 minutes a day. For children ages 2 to 5, that bumps up a little bit to about 1 hour on a weekday, school day, and 3 hours on weekend days. And so it still averages out to less than 1.5 hours or so a day. And for 6 and older, all the way through adolescence, this is the hard one for teenagers if they're listening, 2 hours a day. That's for recreational screen use, not school related. And I know a lot of kids, I'll use air quotes here, you can't see it, multitask. They really don't do well when they try that. But 2 hours of recreational screen time that includes video gaming, spending time on social media platforms, it's really a small amount. And there's a reason for it. It's not that a bunch of doctors ganged up and said, let's make children's lives miserable, although they might feel that way. It's really because we know that excessive screen time, especially for developing children, for their minds, it really does have some difficult effects on them, all the way through adolescence, in fact. And so I hope we can get into that a little bit.
Yeah, and Carol in Iowa actually has a question that relates to this. So let's go there. Carol, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I have a grandson who has pretty much left the family. I mean, everybody, he's living actually with the other grandparents, but he never comes out. In fact, he has some younger brothers, quite a bit younger, who have said he's a nocturnal, which, it maybe sounds amusing, but I think he is addicted to video games, and he left college, and he left his job.
Mm. And he's always in front of the computer, you're saying, Carol.
Correct, yes.
No.
Yeah, I mean, my purposes are really for children, young children, but I can speak to that if it's okay. I can't, of course, diagnose or anything from a phone call or a conversation like this. But there is definitely, and the research supports this, I teach a course at the university here in La Crosse on addictive behaviors, and I've been tracking this for the past decade and a half. There's definitely a relationship or a lot of similarities between the use of addictive substances and certain addictive behaviors, like excessive use of screens, video gaming, of all of the screens that are used by children, teenagers, and adults, probably have the most addictive potential because of the immediate feedback loop, the dopamine hits that kids get when they're playing a game, all the positive reinforcement for getting to the next level, that kind of thing. And so while in this country we have not formally identified screens as a formal addiction in our diagnostic and statistical manual, it's a thing. It's something that we're moving toward, and I expect in the next decade or so we'll be saying, yes, this is an addictive behavior just like gambling. And so it's something that it causes impairment in relationships. It causes difficulties in jobs. It causes difficulties with people just getting on with life when they're spending that much time plugged in.
Yeah. Carol, thank you for calling. And we'll talk some more. And, you know, in her case or in her grandson's case, you know, it sounds like he needs some help from somebody like you.
Or someone who specializes with adults, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and by the way, I want to give a shout out to Ann in Sturgeon Bay. Ann recommended that we talk about this topic, and so I want to give her some props for it. There's, in the first place, why, you know, there's been all kinds of studies in the past about TV, and I can remember years back, you know, the stories about TV is turning our kids' minds into mush. And now we've got TV, but we also have those other screens. And it seems that parents allow their children to have unlimited time, or some parents at least.
Yeah. Well, and you were talking about the number of screens that you have in front of you, and I was smiling at that because if you remember back, and I'm a product of the 1950s, and so I don't want to go back too far, but in the 1970s, most families in this country had one electronic device, one digital, or not even digital at the time, but one screen, a television. And by 2015, the average household had 8 screens in their house, if they counted video game systems, television, cell phones, and tablets. By 2024, just 9 years later, we're already averaging about 17 screens per household. It's easily more than one person can handle. And if there's 3 or 4 in a household, you have 3 or 4 choices. And I think one of the challenges we're facing is with so many choices, it's really easy for families to be plugged in to something. And I think one of the challenges that parents run into is they might have their own devices. They might use their screens as a way to de-stress. And they notice their children are quiet when they're plugged in. And that may be the reason, at least it keeps them quiet. So it functions to some extent as a pacifier. They may believe their children are learning something, and they may be learning some things, but they're not learning the important things for their ages, especially young children, like language, social, emotional communication. They don't learn those things from screens. They learn those things from human interaction. And I think that's the part that we really have to get the word out on, so that we see less screen use for young children and more of that parent-child or family interaction.
Yeah, Ann emailed us. She says she feels like there's an issue with parents. They hold their infants or young children while they're looking at their phones instead of making eye contact with them. She's worried about it because of the importance of eye contact with parents for brain development and specifically attachment and emotional regulation. Could you comment on that?
Oh, I would love to. That is absolutely a thing. And when you think about the more time that parents are spending looking at a screen and not making eye contact, it's called the attachment gaze. It does make it difficult for children to know what they're looking at. Some of you may have ever seen the still face experiment, which is a wonderful study that's been done that looks at how children attend to what parents' facial expressions are looking like. When parents aren't reacting, when they're not responding, it causes a fair amount of distress, even very young children, even if it's just for a few minutes. And so I think that the neural wiring, the brain development that goes on when children are looking at facial expressions, where we get most of our information about what's going on in the world with other people, how to read affect, where the eyes are, what we're looking at, how to learn about emotions, that happens through that eye gaze that occurs between parents and children. And when parents are looking at something else while they're feeding, while they're bottle feeding their child, or while they're just in the same room, they're missing out on a lot, both parents and kids.
Samantha in Galesville has a question or comment. Hi, Samantha.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering, I'm 42, I'll be 43 in August, and I was wondering, when I was growing up, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, we had TVs and such, but, you know, things were just starting to come out and new technologies, but we played outside on the family farm, or if we lived in town when my parents were divorced and my mom lived in town, and we played outside till the street lamp came on, and, you know, all kinds of things, and, you know, got ourselves tired that way. And we did a few chores, but otherwise it was mostly just playing outside. So what I'm wondering is, how do you get the kids of the, you know, later generation of the, maybe the, you know, now growing up in the, you know, late 90s, maybe way like 99 to the 2000s and such, to get them off of those screen time when they started, when they're in like preschool or kindergarten.
Or even before that, yeah. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, it sounded like my childhood. So being able to play outside, and there's certainly a, you know, screen time versus green time, just being outside. But one of the challenges that we do, I think, and I don't want parents to leave this conversation thinking that they're doing something wrong. But if I can quote Maya Angelou, we do the best we can until we know better. And when we know better, we do better. And I really think that with more information about how to guide children, we're going to be more effective. And so rather than say, get off your devices or go play outside, sometimes kids need a little bit more detail about what their options are. And so maybe as a young child, the caller was able to have a lot of creativity, but when we've been plugged in for a long time, everything compared to a screen is boring. And that's a common word that kids say. It's like, I'm bored. It's like code for, can I plug in? Can I get on my TV or my tablet or whatever? And so what I really encourage parents to do is, and every family has to do this differently because no family has the same kind of resources or the same environment that they live in, is to make lists. The first list is all the things a child can do by themselves at home on a rainy day. And it becomes a year-round indoor list.
We'll talk some more with Jeff Ryland, a therapist in the Department of Behavioral Health at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. He'll be with us till 12:30, and we'll be back right after the news. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about screen time as it relates to our children with our guest, Jeff Ryland. He is a therapist in the Department of Behavioral Health at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Jeff's specialty is marriage and family counseling. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. How are you helping the children in your life engage in imaginative play, for example, instead of watching the phone or the television all the time? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Jeff, I want to go back to our last caller, because our last caller before our news break talked about how she spent a lot of time outdoors as a youngster and wants to know how we can get kids back outside. And you had a suggestion, and that was really a good one, which involved lists. But talk about that.
Making lists, because it's a visual prompt for kids and for parents. And so the first list, all the things they can do, a child can do by themselves in the house on a rainy day. Second list, all the things they can do with at least one more person. Could be a sibling, could be a friend, could be a parent. And so making a list of board games and card games, and not just listing that broad category, but every single game in the house, every single activity that can be done, working on puzzles together, whatever things, baking in the kitchen. And so you've got these, literally these menus of activities that can be done inside. Same thing can be done outside, but because we live in the upper Midwest, there are some weather concerns that you might want to make lists that maybe are seasonal. And so when kids are saying, I'm bored, there's nothing to do, and a parent says, well, look at the list. Look at all the choices we have. Screen time happens later in the day. I like to think about screen time as like dessert. It's a treat that you have after you've done the work of childhood. And the work of childhood during a day involves thinking and problem-solving skills, physical activity, social-emotional skills, and then recreational helping skills. If you've done all the work of the day as a child, you should get a little bit of screen time after dinner, well before bedtime, but not something that starts the day. It'd be like having ice cream for breakfast. And once you've had ice cream for breakfast, are you really going to want to eat anything else? You know, so I think that it just makes a lot of sense to use screen time as a reward for doing the work of childhood, which is getting outside, doing things that are physical. So we see a reduction in the childhood obesity problem that is happening in this country, partly because of the excess amount of time kids are spending on screens.
Yeah, I love that list idea. That is a very good one, because I've been caught with that myself. Going outside, well, this is years back, but I didn't have a list. And so, you'll find something, and that doesn't work nearly as well as giving an exact, here are some options.
And what can be really helpful is it really empowers a child to participate in the decision making and planning and problem solving. I can do this first, I can do this second, and then maybe mom and I or mom can offer, how about if you do two of these things on your list and then we can do this together? So it really involves teaching kids how to communicate, how to take turns, how to share, how to engage in flexible thinking. And it really eliminates the parent having to be the recreation director, planning all the ideas, and the child saying, no, that sounds boring. But if screen time happens like at 4 o'clock on a Saturday or 5:30 or 6 o'clock after dinner on a weekday, then the child knows that they've got other things they can do to occupy their time. And it's not a constant battle with parents either chasing kids off devices or telling them they have to wait. And really, I think it just sets families up to have less negative interaction and more positive activity. Sometimes older kids will say, I don't want to go to my sister's concert because I'm going to get cheated out of my screen time tonight. And I say, you never lose screen time. It's one of my favorite things to say to kids. You should never lose screen time, but you have to earn all of it. And so parents can say, you know what, we want you to go to your sister's concert. And so you can bank that screen time. You can have it for those 2 hours that you get. You can use them another time, rainy day, sleep over with a friend. Or if you don't want to use them, you can always cash them in for something that maybe you want to get those shoes that are a little more expensive than we would otherwise buy. We'll chip in this much and you can give us some screen time back. And so you kind of buy back the screen time. That way, it's not going to be a battle. The kids are losing it. They just always use it if they can't get it all in that night.
Love those ideas. I had an email from someone who said, I've heard that some kids' shows are created to be extremely stimulating. They use a lot of bright colors, quick camera movement. And that can be addictive for young children. What do you think about that? Are there shows that offer lower stimuli for kids and would be better options?
Well, the answer is yes, there are shows that are really exciting and they've got a lot of stimulation and children get almost nothing out of them. Because for young children especially, they're not able to make any sense of any kind of storyline because they don't have that part of their brain developed enough yet. And so really fast, rapidly paced shows that have lots of activity going on, they might keep a child's attention, but they're not learning anything from that experience. And yes, there are shows, like Sesame Street, that's a classic, Sesame Street, or anything that's on PBS for children is usually really well done and it's designed to teach. But for young children, it's always best if children and parents watch together until about the age of 2. And so they've got that experience, or 3, I think. And so they've got that experience where they're sharing those things and parents can use their language. And that's one of the challenges. What prompted us to reach out had to do with the study that came out just last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics on the link between excessive screen time and language delays in children. And language is so important for children because they learn how, as they get older, how to use their words instead of being aggressive. And so we see a precipitous drop in aggression between the ages of 3 and 5 as kids acquire language. But when they're watching screens all the time, parents aren't talking to them, and they're not using language either. And there's a drop in the amount of interaction between parents and children when they're watching too much screen time.
Yeah, I was amazed. Thanks for sending that article along so we could take a look at it. The number of words dropped here we're talking, I think there was one where a three-year-old who was using about almost 3 hours a day on a screen. Right. Talk about that.
Yeah, the study really looked at, it was a really well-done study using some pretty high-tech equipment to try to measure the amount of language that children had while screens were on in the house. And so the researchers extrapolated. They said an average child in the United States and many developed countries, it's about 3 hours a day of screen time they get. And so when screens are even when it's background television, parents use fewer words, children use fewer words, and there are fewer back and forth conversations between kids and parents. And so the study actually identified, they estimated it would be about 1,139 adult words, 843 vocalizations from children to communicate back, and almost 200 conversations that get lost in a day when parents and kids aren't communicating because of screens. And so when you think about how children learn, it's layer upon layer and repetition upon repetition over time. And when you take out, much like the attachment gaze we talked about earlier, when you reduce by half the amount of conversation going on in a household, or the amount of attachment or amount of gazing, eye contact between parents and children, that is going to have an impact on that child's social emotional development.
It's an amazing, amazing thing. I could hardly believe it was really striking, those differences. Well, Stella in Sturgeon Bay, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to, earlier you said something about how children get totally focused in on screens. I wanted to share an experience from when my siblings and I were probably from toddler to about kindergarten age, and the only screens available at that time were the very beginnings of television and movie theaters, and we visited some cousins, and for the first time in our lives in us kids' lives, and I guess my parents too, probably, we experienced television. Our cousins had gotten a television. And we three children just sat there completely mesmerized, unmoving, just totally focused on that television for I don't know how long it was played. And my mother came away from that experience saying, anything that keeps children that young, that still, for that long is not good.
Stella, thank you for calling. Jeff, you probably agree with that.
Oh, my. I absolutely. She's right, and her mother was really wise to notice that. I think that, again, screens are, they have this ability to mesmerize children, young children especially, and I think that, again, they're not all bad. I don't want people to leave this discussion thinking that we're saying screens are bad. Everything in moderation, and what's too much, I think, is really important to try to figure out. That's why the pediatric guidelines are there. But screens are, I like it. You know, when you think about your own childhood, what are your favorite memories? I ask parents, what are your favorite memories of childhood? And it's so much fun to hear groups of families or parents talk about all the fun things they did as kids. And never once has somebody said watching TV was a favorite memory. Yeah. Never once has somebody said, you know, this thing that I did all by myself and with a screen was my favorite thing. It's always, you know, stargazing or digging for worms in the garden or catching butterflies or playing hide and seek or whatever activities. You know, the only time a screen's been involved is what Stella was talking about, going to a movie theater, a drive-in theater, and having popcorn and blankets in the car. And that's a memory because everyone's doing it together. And so, you know, screens are like, I like to say watching videos or screens is like Jell-O. It's filling, but it has no nutritional value.
Yeah.
And so it's not a really good thing to take up too much time in a child's day or their life.
Phyllis in Madison, your turn. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, thank you. Well, I want to bring up a radical idea that I think your guest can't almost, and that is you can just decide when you're having kids not to have a television. And we made that decision when I was pregnant with our first child and still don't have a television, whatever it is, 37 years later. And it's just easier sometimes to have none than to say, oh, you can have this much and argue about how much, and then they go on and turn on the television themselves anyway. But of course it takes a lot more time because then you have to spend time with them, which of course I was happy to do. But I remember one child who played with our kids, and I was trying to settle them down. Something had happened. I said, let's read a book. Started reading a book that my children loved. And this child said, there's not, what do you say? Some of these pictures aren't even in color. And I could tell that he was not used to listening to books being read, and that television, as you said earlier, is so exciting, and a book in comparison pales. And my children, you know, grew up to read a lot, and I think that's because we didn't have a TV.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff?
I can't say that. I think lots of people would like not to have as many TVs. We certainly don't want TVs in bedrooms. That's another pediatric guideline. No televisions in bedrooms. I would like to add no televisions in bedrooms for adults, which is, again, kind of a radical idea. When my family was growing up, when my kids were young, we had a television, but we kept it behind a cupboard, so it was never out. And so we had very limited use, and to this day, I might watch a television maybe once every 6 months. I just don't have a big need for it. But I think that it's a part of our society, and we want our kids to have some connection to other kids. And many kids have devices, and so there's a balance between not having access to any of it and at least knowing what it's like. We decided to have our kids watch a Christmas special when my oldest was 8 years old. They'd never seen a TV, never watched a show before. And when the commercial came on, they got up to go to bed because they'd never seen a commercial. And we thought, oh my gosh, we maybe have gone a little too far over here. We should expose them a little bit to the world and what life is like. And our kids, they're fine because they do know how to video game and they all have computers and all that. But again, it's at that young age, it's limiting their access so their brains have time to grow and learn the things they really need to learn. And that happens in the context of relationships, not from a screen.
Yeah. We have a listener in Madison with a comment or question. Hi, thank you for calling.
I don't even know which comment to choose. I'm a mother. My children were born in 99 and 2002, and it has been a lifelong battle. I think one of the problems is that the schools are feeling compelled to introduce electronics like Chromebooks and computers in the school as part of the curriculum, at the same time that parents are battling at home this addiction to screens.
Yeah.
And so there's information in the whole school about drugs and how damaging they are, but at the same time, they're exposing the children to drugs, which are the screens, and the kids spend a lot of their energy and time trying to look at memes and jokes and videos while they're learning about computers. And the computer companies are actually donating the computers to the schools as part of the curriculum. But it's also getting them addicted. Even if you don't have the screens at home, they get addicted at school.
Jeff, a comment?
Yeah, I certainly have seen that in my clinical practice where kids are used to having devices at school. And I try to make a distinction between computer use, like what Larry's doing with those devices in front of him, what I do in my office. We have those things for work. Many times children have those things that are required for their schoolwork. And so when we're talking about screen use, we're talking about recreational screen use. And unfortunately, as you just talked about, or you mentioned, that kids toggle back and forth. They might open a tab in some other area. And so when they're supposed to be doing their homework, they might be on TikTok or they might be going over and looking at YouTube videos. And that's a real challenge because the research has been overwhelming that kids don't multitask any more than adults can multitask very well, that you can't do two or three things at once and really do them well. And so kids don't learn as well when they're trying to go back and forth between their homework and doing the other stuff they'd rather do. So when parents have homework to do at home with their kids, I think for young children especially, it's best to say, we're going to do it here at the kitchen table, or we can make sure we get the homework done. And then that screen gets put away. All the more reason, if you're concerned about your kids having too much screen time at school, to make sure they've got a really language-rich and also activity-rich environment at home. And that's why those lists can be so helpful, because they're prompts that you can just point to, like a menu at a restaurant. Here are your choices. Look at all the things you can do before you get plugged in again.
Hmm. Liz and Madison wondered if single parents use screens in different ways. She had a single mom, and she gave her a list of books she had to read outside of school. And Liz thinks it's important for kids to use their imagination. We get very influenced and caught up in others' lives.
I do think that single parents do have that added burden of trying to do a lot with less adults involved in the story sometimes. And so screens can serve that function of, I know my child is safe. I know they're occupied while I'm getting dinner ready. Again, I think it's a balancing act that parents have to figure out. How do I make it so that I can time my child's, their usage of screen, their involvement with recreational screens, with my activity, my time with them also. So I think it's a hazard, but it's not just families that with single parents that struggle with this.
Well, I like Liz's mom's idea of giving her a list of books that to read outside of school. And so there was the time was book time, not screen time.
Oh, absolutely. Screen time versus green time, book time, any other kinds of activities. And in fact, that's how kindergartens run. They have music time, they have circle time, they have activity time. They've got all kinds of different times in their 15-minute segments that are broken up. And so, because that's about the attention span of a kindergartner. And so if families, we can't be that structured in a home environment, but we can say, we're going to go outside this afternoon when it's nice out. And then we're going to do this craft project before dinner. And then we're, so kids can know what to look forward to and can anticipate. They do really well with structure. Kids need that. Young children especially need to have predictability and structure and routine in addition to the nurturing in their lives in order for their development to proceed well.
So we got around a minute or just a little longer to summarize. What can parents, we know they shouldn't be on the screens as much as they are. What should parents or grandparents do?
Well, I think it would be really helpful if first we adults step back and look at what our screen time use is and what our involvement is. This may come as a surprise, but the recommendations from the National Institute of Health for adult screen use is about 2 hours a day for recreational screen time. It's no different than for children or teenagers. And so when we're looking at our own use, we're both modeling our access to screens. And some adults have a hard time not checking their phones during dinner or texting or social media, whatever they're doing. And so finding out, how do I put this away? How do I model that I don't need this unless there's an emergency that I need to be available for? How do I model how to show my kids that I don't need this either? We can all have screen-free time during the day, meal times, family activity times, I think would be a great start. Using lists like that for younger children, especially making sure we're talking with them, that we're having conversations with them, that we have a language-rich environment. I love the idea of having books that children can read when they're old enough to pick their own books, but also that we can read to children as part of our routine with them every day.
Jeff, I hope we have a chance to do this again. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to another visit, hopefully. Jeff Ryland is a family therapist in the Department of Behavioral Health at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. We'll try and get him back and do this again. And thank you for listening. Tomorrow we'll learn about what anglers are doing to protect trout streams. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mealer.